You're listening to The Gold Standard, Episode 30, Howard Shore, The Art of the Score.
Hello, everybody. I'm Brian Levine, and welcome to The Gould Standard, a podcast brought to you by the Glenn Gould Foundation. And we're here once again, bringing you conversations with some of the most remarkable people from all across the world of the arts. If film, music, novels, poetry, visual art, theater, and design are what direct your feet to the sunny side of the street, you have come to the right place, my friends. But first, while you're stopping by under our flickering neon piano sign, please do take a moment to press like, share, and subscribe. And if you just so happen to be listening on Apple Podcasts, please kindly leave your reviews, pose your questions, and be part of our community of friends and supporters. While you're at it, be sure to check out our past episodes featuring such luminaries as Sir Kenneth Branagh, Petula Clark, Kat Von D, Laurie Anderson, Viggo Mortensen, Sandra Radvanovsky, and Tatiana Maslany. And to get more simply splendid sounds, witty words, and illuminating images, we'd love you to pay us a visit at our website, glenngould.ca. When you're there, if you're seized with an irresistible impulse to click the donate button and support the charitable work of the Glenn Gould Foundation, well, don't let me talk you out of it. Now, our guest today is Howard Shore, one of the finest and most multidimensional musicians I know. He's performed in a legendary Canadian rock band. He's a multi-instrumentalist. He has a strong affinity for jazz, but is steeped in the classical tradition as well. He's led an iconic television band and has composed exquisite concert music, including a piano concerto for Lang Lang, a powerful opera based on a sci-fi classic, song cycles, chamber works, and a fanfare for the largest musical instrument on planet Earth. But of course, the largest and best-known part of Howard's work are his incomparable film scores. He scored almost all of David Cronenberg's films, starting with The Brood in 1979, making for one of the most memorable film and music partnerships since Alfred Hitchcock and Bernard Herrmann. He has collaborated 6 times with Martin Scorsese, including such memorable productions as Gangs of New York, The Departed, and The Aviator. Other unforgettable collaborations include Tim Burton on the film Ed Wood, Jonathan Demme with Silence of the Lambs and Philadelphia, and even Jon Stewart's directorial debut, Rosewater. And then, of course, there is his truly epic collaboration with Peter Jackson on 6 films based on the works of fantasy master J.R.R. Tolkien, one of the most ambitious film scoring projects in the history of cinema and one of the most musically powerful. Howard has received 3 Academy Awards, 3 Golden Globes, 4 Grammys, a Governor General's Performing Arts Award, and the Order of Canada. What I love about his music is its melodic richness and the brilliant palette of tone colors, but also its psychological nuance and its subtlety, the emotional depth and curiosity that he brings to each of the dramatic situations. Howard, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Brian. Good to see you. Good to be here.
Great to have you. I'd like to start our conversation by talking about your earliest musical experiences. When did you first begin to learn an instrument, and when did you first start thinking about becoming a musician?
I started with a test that was given to all grade school students in Canada called the Seashore Test. Are you familiar with that?
It was gone by the time I went through the Toronto school system.
It was given to every student in Canada. It was a hearing test for hearing for relationships and for pitch, volume. You know, it was a way to test to see if there was potentially musicians in the classroom. And I scored high on the test. I think I was about 8 years old. It was 1954. And I was offered an instrument, and I chose the clarinet because I liked jazz, and Benny Goodman was popular. And I thought that was a way to, you know, to start to learn about music. So the ears were the first indication, and then the clarinet. And then luckily my teacher on the clarinet was Morris Weinzweig. That was John Weinzweig's brother.
The great Canadian musical pioneer. I remember every time that you'd go to a school symphony concert, they would play The Dance from the Red Ear of Corn by John Weinzweig. It was kind of like our version of Copland's Rodeo.
Right. And so I had Morris, as well as giving the young student the clarinet lesson, gave him lessons in counterpoint and harmony and little primers. And then I started writing every week. I had to do an exercise in counterpoint, and he taught me harmony. And that pencil moving on the page was exactly what I do every morning now, years and years later.
That's amazing. And amazing that you would get such in-depth beyond just the rudiments of how to, you know, get the right pitches out of the instrument. You were born in Toronto at a time of post-war expansion. A lot of economic and cultural growth was going on. And we were getting a lot of what I call sophisticated new ideas coming from Europe with a large waves of immigration. And I think you went to Forest Hill Colleges, which is in Midtown, right?
On Eglinton, yes, which might be considered Midtown now. I don't know. We didn't have that term then. There was no Midtown.
Well, it's you know, things have stretched farther north, so it's probably, you know, closer to downtown now. But right. Anyway, so I'm also guessing that you occasionally would go take in a movie at the old Eglinton's Theater.
Yes.
When did you first become aware that there was such a thing as film music? And were there any films that early on made a particular impression on you?
Yeah, my interest was always in music. So, I mean, I was really searching out ideas in music, and I was listening to a lot of music all during the 50s, late 50s, and into the 60s. And, of course, now, I mean, I'm an ardent listener. So movies were still, like, for me, of less of an interest than I think early on. It was more about what was going on in music. But film music seemed a way to get into the recording studio, and I was interested in the technology. So that sparked my interest in film music.
Fascinating. And you, I think, have occasionally mentioned going to the old Avenue Road Music Library. The Toronto Library System used to have a dedicated music library across the road from what's now Glenn Gould Park, and actually on the same block as his apartment. And as I recall, you found that a real source of opening up some new horizons, right?
Avenue Road, the library, was extremely important to me because they had a wonderful section of vinyl recordings, and they had a lot of tapes, reel-to-reel tapes that you could, you know, sign out. And they had music from all over the world. And I was discovering music of Toru Takemitsu, Georges Delerue, Nina Rota, I was interested in, because I was interested also in those Italian films I would see as a student. So that library became really important. I was taking scores out and studying scores, and yeah.
And then you pursued your advanced music education at the Berklee School, which of course is seen as one of the more interesting and progressive schools because, you know, rather than focusing only on grounding in the classics, they were early on to embrace popular music and jazz. Right. Was that part of your reason for choosing that school?
You know, I was interested in jazz, and it was a very open system of education. It wasn't accredited when I went to Berklee. I think it was in 1965. but I could study composition there with John Bavicki, the great choral composer, and got my interest in writing for the voice and for writing for choirs, which later showed up in scores like Looking for Richard and then into Fellowship of the Ring. But it sparked my interest in composition. And I had Ray Santisi taught counterpoint and John LaPorta taught harmony. So they opened the door to Duke Ellington and Igor Stravinsky. And off I went. I mean, I was just like the most curious student. How do you create these pieces, you know? So
eclecticism was very much kind of close to the core for you, really, from early on. Also, early on, you scored a couple of really huge career landmarks and at the same time made a couple of really big career shifts. You were a founding member of one of Canada's legendary rock jazz fusion bands, Lighthouse, and then you became the first music director on Saturday Night Live. And in both cases, you basically made a 180 and left first from Lighthouse to Saturday Night and then from Saturday Night to write for film. Was that hard? I mean, you were having a lot of success to just say, I'm going to do something completely different now.
Well, one kind of went into the other. Like I was with Lighthouse, you know, as a founding member of the group. I recorded 8 studio albums with Lighthouse in 4 years. We did 1,000 one-nighters. We do 250 one-night gigs a year. So I was constantly touring and traveling. And at the later part of the Lighthouse years, Lorne and I were doing a show for CBC called the Lorne and Hart Terrific Hour. Mm-hmm. And I used Lighthouse as the house band for the show. They did all the pre-records. So I kind of got the rock group into the TV world.
Interesting.
With Lorne. And then the thing with television is that the summer is always hiatus. At least it was then. And so each summer I would do a film because I had the time off from doing TV.
And of course, Lorne, you mean Lorne Michaels, yes, the creator of Saturday Night Live. And you'd known him like earlier on in a non-music, you'd gone to summer camp with him, right?
I met Lorne when I was 13 or 14. He's a couple years older than me. We did shows at camp, like summer stock kind of shows. You know, we did musicals and we acted together in musicals. We directed each other. You know, it was a very interesting period for both Lorne and myself. And then we went into CBC radio and then we did CBC television and then to New York, and then Saturday Night Live.
Right.
With a stop in L.A. for a few years for Lorne.
And it's so interesting. I mean, just to get back to Lighthouse, I mean, it was a very successful band. I mean, you were playing major gigs. You were on the same bill as people like Elton John and for, was it Hendrix? You were open for Hendrix?
At the Isle of Wight, we opened for Hendrix.
Yeah.
Elton John opened for us in Philadelphia at the Electric Factory.
I hope you run into him and remind him of that from time to time. That's fantastic. So Saturday Night Live, did you basically have the job of putting the band together as well as, you know, I mean, how did your responsibilities on the show develop?
Well, I was music director, you know, so anything that had to do with music, I was involved with. I was involved with booking music acts, putting music to sketches. I was writing original pieces for the house band. I wrote the opening and closing theme. The house band was based on my work from Lighthouse. Mm-hmm. It was basically a version of Lighthouse without the string quartet. And so I had all that history of the rock period, and I just chose the things that I liked specifically for the sound of Saturday Night Live. I was interested in Stax Volt and Junior Walker and R&B, which was less of what Lighthouse did.
Right.
But it used that same combination of a rhythm section and a horn section.
Live from New York, it's Saturday Night!
And of course, you were going live to air, so if anything unexpected happened, basically you had to live with it, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I did 105, I think, live broadcasts, and you know, you learn to work under pressure. It was a good period for learning to work with writers and directors and you know other people in a production. It prepared you for working in films, to collaborate in working on films.
Right. And of course, the legendary cast members who we think of now were your colleagues.
Yes, of course. We all had, day-to-day working, good working relationships with the cast, fantastic cast, Dan Aykroyd, and Chevy Chase, Gilda Radner, Lorraine Newman, Garrett Morris, incredible.
John Belushi, yeah. Yeah. So one year you're still at Saturday Night, and the next year you're basically scoring films full time. Did it kind of work out that way?
Well, I did the films in the summer. Like The Brood was done. I wrote it during the summer, again, of a hiatus from the show, I think in 78, 79, one of those years. And then I did the score to Scanners and Videodrome, early Cronenberg scores, all done while I was at Saturday Night Live.
Mm.
Although I think Videodrome maybe was 80, 81, came right after we left NBC.
By that time, did you basically now conceive of yourself as a full-time film composer? Was that kind of the identity that you had evolved into by that point?
No. I think, the interest in music, I wasn't restricting myself really to film. I was doing other things. I worked on Gilda Radner's show, produced her album for Broadway. And, you know, I was interested in whatever I could do that seemed of interest or was put me in a good learning position musically.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was writing pieces, more contemporary pieces for a string trio, if I could get string group together, for small brass ensembles, woodwind groups, you know, anything I could do to advance my composition, I was interested in. It was always based on the composition process. So, I just did things that came along. You know, opportunities presented themselves.
Well, obviously, those early experiences with David Cronenberg resulted in a pretty astonishing collaboration. It's how many films now together?
We just finished a new film called Crimes of the Future. It's our 16th film.
16 films. That's
yes,
an incredible partnership. How did you two discover each other?
Well, I knew David's a few years older than me, and I knew his films from late night screenings in Toronto and underground film festivals, things of that nature. So when I was a teenager, like 17, 18, I was watching David's films, and I kind of knew David peripherally. You know, we had not mutual friends, but we had relatives and things that knew the Cronenberg. And so I was very aware of his work, and I waited maybe 5 or 6 years before I approached him. And I had done one film before The Brood called I Miss You, Hugs and Kisses, and he knew about that.
Ah.
And so when I approached him, he said, oh, yeah, I saw that film. He said, yeah, let's try working together. And he gave me a chance, and we've continued. We've sort of grown up together, you know, on films, learning how to work with a director, composer-composer-director relationship.
Those early films were, I suppose, what you could still describe as his early low-budget period. So presumably your budgets for the scores and the recording of the scores must have been commensurately pretty modest.
Oh, yes.
Did that teach you some special disciplines or how to...
It did, indeed. It's true. That's a good question because I know on The Brood, the score was written for 21 strings. I recorded it in 7 hours, 1 hour of overtime.
Oh, man.
I think it cost $12,000. So you learn to work very quickly and efficiently and, you know, budgets were... It was important to stay within a budget.
Right.
It taught me a lot.
And also with modest forces to create effects that could basically sound like more than, you know, what people might imagine you'd be working with.
Yeah, well, the early years, I mean, The Brood was completely acoustic score, I think, with those 21 strings. And the Scanners video drum, they were now delving into analog electronics.
Right.
Which I was interested in as a kid. I had tape recorders. I was splicing tape and looping tape and, you know, using all those early electronic music techniques. I love Takemitsu's music of that period, 60s. And he was creating electronic scores that I was influenced by, that I knew and listened to. And a lot of the recordings I got from the Avenue Road Film and Music Library.
Right. And of course, you probably know that Toru Takemitsu was one of the laureates of our Glenn Gould Prize. Sadly, right. He was in his final year when he was chosen and did not live long enough to come to Toronto and receive it. But, you know, what a remarkable body of work and an incredible explorer.
Yes. I met him in Los Angeles. We gave him a composing award, a group that I was part of. And so I did get to meet him, and we had a big dinner presentation for him in Los Angeles.
So as you've mentioned, you know, you've grown up together, in a sense, with David Cronenberg, and that included the real evolution of his work to films with bigger themes and more ambitious budgets and settings. And there's always been a kind of a very strong psychological element, whether it's about transformation and anxieties around the body and so on and so forth. But when I think about the growth in the ambitiousness of the scores, for example, a film like M. Butterfly, which I adore, I absolutely love that score, or Naked Lunch, History of Violence and Eastern Promises, or Dangerous Method, where you actually got to sort of delve into the post-romantic idiom in a pretty big way. It must have been kind of a remarkable thing to have that journey with an artist that you consider a trusted collaborator, and I'm assuming a good friend now, and to see that kind of evolution of horizon.
I'm very grateful for the opportunities that David provided musically. It was a vast palette to work on because in the early period, I had Brood Scanners video drum, all guerrilla type scores done on budgets. And then I could do a completely symphonic score for The Fly.
Right.
And it was the first sessions that I had with the London Philharmonic. And over the 80s, from The Fly 86 to 90 into 2000, those 15 years, 2001, Fellowship of the Ring, was all London Philharmonic, all started with David's films, M. Butterfly with London Philharmonic. So the sound of Lord of the Rings was all developed through those 15 years, all with that same orchestra. And those scores I wrote and orchestrated specifically for the London Phil,
right,
for that orchestra.
And of course, you conduct your own scores.
I conducted those scores, yes.
So the first time you stood on a podium in, would it have been Abbey Road, in front of, you know, 70 or 80 piece orchestra. Did you have a particular kind of anxiety because?
Oh, yes. I did at the time because I didn't really have the experience. I mean, I was kind of self-taught in terms of conducting. I just developed the techniques more for rehearsing, which was what I was used to because I was always working in a recording studio. So the conducting was just efficient. It was a way to realize the orchestration as efficiently as possible because the clock was going. And, you know, when you're in the recording studio, it's much different than being on the podium in front of an audience in a concert performance. The techniques I developed for conducting were all based on this, you know, this early work that I did, even with Lighthouse, because Lighthouse was a rock group that was popular during that period in the 60s and early 70s when rock groups were playing with orchestras.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Knights in White Satin, the Moody Blues, Procol Harum. There was this mingling of symphonic music. So I wrote a piece based on Ravel's Bolero, believe it or not. I played Bolero with a rock band and a full symphony orchestra. And we toured that with, you know, we played in different cities all over Canada. I mean, with Toronto and Winnipeg, Vancouver. And then we did a ballet called Ballet High with Lighthouse. So I was getting on the podium with Lighthouse. And then, so I was used to it a bit. And then as I went into film recording, I had some technique of working with an orchestra.
But still, you know, given that the British orchestras that do film scores are also concert orchestras, and therefore you're standing on a podium in front of people who may have been conducted by Toscanini, Stokowski, Sir Thomas Beecham. I could see where that might be a little daunting.
Well, it's like you got in the slipstream. So when I worked with the London Phil, which I did for many years, over 15 years, whoever was the maestro at the time, you had the benefit of the maestro. I mean, they may have been conducted by Kurt Mazur playing Mahler.
Yes.
The day before. And now they're in the studio with me playing something from Lord of the Rings, you know. So I had the benefit of the beauty of Mazur, you know, and the discipline and focus of Mazur. I could capture that and continue with that.
That never occurred to me, but basically, before everything wears off, you still are enjoying the afterglow.
Yeah, and you have the focus. It's still there because it's the orchestra is all completely tuned and ready for it.
Right. Back to your work with David Cronenberg. With such a long collaboration, have you developed a particular way of working with him? For example, do you develop your thematic material from viewing a rough cut, or is it earlier on at the script stage when you begin to develop some of the ideas about how musically things are going to work? Do you visit the set during production?
I do usually go to the set, pay a visit, but the work that I do with David starts really early on. I always start with the words. As soon as he has a project, a film that he's interested in, he'll send me the script. I'll always refer to the original novels or plays that we're sourcing from. And we've done a lot of adaptions over the years. William Burroughs' Naked Lunch, J.G. Ballard's Crash, Dangerous Method. I'm able to work with the words for quite a long time. And then before I even look at the imagery, I'm already creating. And some scores I've already sort of created the compositions early on, you know, the ideas. And then I work in pencil and paper in a way that allows me to collect ideas every day compositionally. When I start to score the film, I'll look to the folders that I have from the day-to-day composition, ideas that I have about the film away from the film, and then I start to place those into the film specifically in terms of what I call actually scoring the film. It's deciding on where these thematic and motivic ideas belong in the film.
That's fascinating, and it actually brings us to some aspects of your composing methods that I find interesting and also very distinctive for the period that we're living in now, because, you know, film composing seems to have evolved in a way that is, well, let's say far removed from the way it would have been done in Hollywood in the 1930s or 40s or 50s, where these were basically composers for the most part who were trained in the Middle European school of classical composition. So they might see a cut of the film and basically sketch out what would have been effectively a tone poem to accompany the work. Nowadays, my sense is that a lot of composers basically are creating much of the music electronically, using samples, beginning to develop the orchestration. You know, I mean, it's a much more technologically based compositional method, right? for many. And right. So you're in many ways, I hope you don't mind my saying it, old school, in the sense that, you know, you're still composing like a composer of yore with a pencil and using the inside of your head rather than a lot of devices that can be spread out in front of you.
Well, I work in two worlds. I work in a 19th century world. It's true. Pencil and paper. And then I work in a 21st century world that's all technology. A lot of work in film is very technological. So I have both. I have a studio that's into a 19th century world. It's in the forest. It's very quiet. I work by myself. I don't require the internet. I don't require any technology other than a good printer to print out my score by hand. I'll scan the score to the copyist. I've done a lot of scores in the 90s where I would write them by hand, like Ed Wood scores from that period. They're all handwritten in 12-stave small scores in pencil. And then I would fax them to the copyist. He would put the parts on the stand. I'd fly to London and record them that way without any technology other than that. But now the scores are still 19th century, written by hand, scanned to the copyist, and then it goes to the studio, which is a couple miles away from where I am. That's very technological, and you can communicate there all over the world. We've done remote sessions in the Far East, in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the US, all from the studio, which has a fantastic surround sound setup for listening. So we have at any mock-ups of the score, meetings with the director, they're all done in the studio. So I kind of work in both worlds. And it's very linear. I start, the composition is developed first in terms of harmony and counterpoint. No orchestration comes later, so everything is very linear.
Right. And you orchestrate almost all of your own scores.
Well, I do now, and it was really just more for efficiency. Because if I was going to conduct them, it was the fastest way, if you orchestrated them, to get the best result. And there's no broken telephone. It's just you and the orchestration and the podium and the orchestra. So.
And you can be sure that it sounds the way you really want it to if you do it yourself.
If you put the B flat there, that's where the B flat's going to be. And that was
right.
That was good. And if it's not right, then just change it. And yeah, and you don't have to go through a whole process of doing it.
And you know that the B flat is played by an English horn rather than, let's say, a contrabassoon, right, in a different register.
Right.
Well, that's fascinating. And I think that kind of dual method is one reason. I'd like to speculate why so much of your film music also works so well as concert music. It really stands the test when you take it away from the film context and play it in a concert version.
Part of that is that I've always felt that if you have good structure in the music, it will help to structure the film.
Well, that brings me to another aspect of your method, and you've already talked a little bit about it in the context of your work with Cronenberg, and that is you do a lot of research and reading, even before seeing any of the film. And it strikes me that that is a very literary and also a somewhat intellectual approach, because you're thinking about not just what the film is going to look like or where the points of dramatic action will be, but, what are the the pervasive ideas? What is the period, the milieu? What was the writer trying to say? And it's something that I think adds also a lot of depth to the work that you do, that it isn't necessarily just, this is the point at which I have a bass drum beat so that people jump in their seats. In other words, it's not just heightening a particular emotion or driving a particular action sequence forward. It's really becoming kind of a commentary on the inner life of the film.
Right. Thank you. And I try to deepen the story. I try to get into the subtext and broaden the scope of the narrative in a way that you can do with music. Remember that a good score can speak directly to the audience. I can speak to the audience directly and go around any other process of the film. So music's can be very powerful. And the techniques you're describing now are ones that I've developed on all the Cronenberg films, because we were always working around the frame, trying to look at new ways of using music in film.
And that's one thing that I think is really part of the power of film music, is that it can basically, as you say, bypass the surface level of plot or character development or dialogue and achieve a conversation with your psychology at a subliminal level. So, I mean, one thing that I think is a very constant element in Cronenberg's films is a sense of deep disquiet and unease. And you're able to sort of capture that even in some of the more innocuous sequences that are really layups for the climactic moments, that I think generates a lot of that inner tension.
I think it's pervasive in a lot of the work that we did, that opens up the story to the audience in a way for I wanted to transport the audience into the world of the film and let them discover the film.
Exactly.
It was always a sense of discovery that I was hoping to take them on the journey of the Cronenberg film.
Yeah.
The techniques of the Cronenberg don't necessarily work on all films, though. It really had to do with the relationship that I had with David and his writing.
Right.
For instance, the work that I did with Tolkien and Peter Jackson couldn't relate that to the techniques that I used for Cronenberg, where I didn't use themes and motifs. They weren't so specifically utilized for clarity of storytelling, which I was doing in the Tolkien. So as a good composer for film, you want to help the film as much as possible, not instill your ideas into it, unless they're really a good collaboration with the direction of the film. They're not all the same. Like, you have to take different approaches for each project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I want to get to that and do a little compare and contrast. One other thing is the really rich palette of sonorities that you tap into across the span of your work, you know, your extensive use of choral music and so on, but also the use of interesting and unusual instruments, like, for example, historical electronic instruments like theremin and onde martinot, and instruments from non-Western cultures. Do you develop a kind of a sense of how you want it to sound along with the thematics? And do you sometimes have to go hunting for the right instrument to capture that sonority that you have in your mind, or is it more culturally referenced?
Sometimes you have to go searching for the players. I found great players in London because you could draw from Europe and from Africa. I did a score called The Cell, where I brought a Moroccan orchestra from Tangier, from the Reef Mountains of Morocco, to London. And they played live with the London Phil.
That must have
at Air Studios. That was, I don't know if you know that film. It's a kind of rarity.
I don't think I've seen that. I'm going to have to go hunt for that now.
I am interested. You know, again, as a student, you know, I was interested in recordings from different parts of the world. Anybody who's interested in composition, I think, would be interested in learning about other instruments.
Right.
I've used instruments from the Far East, from Northern Europe, a lot of African instruments have been used in my scores, Celtic instruments, of course.
Right.
So, yeah, I think in a way, to me, the orchestration is something that comes, it's almost at the end of the process. It's kind of like, you know, it's composition, harmony, counterpoint, and then the orchestration is more how to realize the composition and what's really required in terms of the orchestration. And so some of these specialty pieces are used, you know, for specific reasons in a film.
I'd like to chat about a few specific scores, and I have to admit that I indulged myself in choosing some favorites of my own, if that's okay with you. One that I've already made reference to is M. Butterfly. It's such a delicate and yet emotionally charged score. It has elements that feel distinctly operatic, and in fact, two different cultural worlds of opera are referenced in the film, Peking opera and Western opera, with Madama Butterfly being the touch point. But in your evocation of Chinese culture, you really avoid stereotypes and obvious cliches. How did you evolve the musical concepts? And did that idea of comparing and contrasting two different operatic worlds figure in the concept?
It did. Yeah, I became interested in Chinese opera and was listening to a lot of Chinese opera at the time, and actually recorded the Chinese opera piece in Beijing with Chinese orchestra. The score was recorded in London with the London Phil, and it's based on a counterpoint I was interested in for two harps, orchestral harps. And to show you the connection between the compositions, like, you could look at the Cronenberg work as one long, the 16 films as one large piece, because the two harps was the first time I wrote for two harps, and I put them in spatially. Films were now developed into left, center, right, and then two rear speakers. It was called a 5.1 surround. And I was interested in this image, spatial image. And I put the harps left and right of the conductor in the middle of the orchestra and wrote a counterpoint for two of them. And then when M. Butterfly was finished, I continued that composition and I wrote it for three parts, three harps, which became the three-part counterpoint of the film Crash.
Mm, interesting.
So that's the connection between M. Butterfly and Crash. It's just an extension of that harp, you know, writing for the three harps. And then the three harp parts were played by six electric guitars, two on each harp, up an octave. And that essentially became the sound of Crash. That's the principal sound of that score.
That's fantastic. Ed Wood, the film you made with Tim Burton.
Yes.
It has this fantastic 1950s period character, and in a sense, it's all about evoking the world of someone working on the lowest shoestring budgets, including the musical approach and sound. Ed Wood presumably could never hire top-flight musicians, and you, I think, tried to evoke that a little bit. I'm wondering, did it harken back to some of those early low-budget experiences with Cronenberg? And it sort of reminds me, because it's a beautiful score and it's beautifully realized, and yet it clearly evokes that sense of put together with shoestrings and baling wax. It reminds me of a classic Dolly Parton line, "Do you know how expensive it is to look this cheap?"
Well, the key to the Ed Wood score, and to the you have to look at the Universal film scores of the 50s, the monster movies. And because they were B films, they used a very small group of musicians. And it's mostly woodwinds and brass and percussion. And there's very few strings because they didn't have the budget. They would use an instrument called the novichord to play the string parts. It was basically kind of a big organ sound. I couldn't find one. There was one in The Hague and a museum, but they wouldn't let me use it. But I ended up using portable organs and mostly woodwinds and brass, and I think about six or eight strings, because that's really the sound of those early, horror films. Ed Wood was fantastic scored to write. Working with Tim Burton was really wonderful, really creative, and allowed you a lot of freedom to create that score. Lydia Kavina played the theremin on the score, and she was in East Berlin doing a show, and we tried to get her a visa to come to London. It was difficult, so we had to work with the Ones Martineau for a while. Cynthia Miller played the parts live with the members of the London Phil, and she played the Ones like the theremin. So there's a bit of Ones in the score, but it's mostly the theremin, Lydia Kavina.
And she had a relationship with Leon Theremin, didn't she? Was she a protege?
Yeah, she was a relative, like a niece. And he taught her how to play. And when I went to Moscow, I spent some time there doing a recording. She took me to his studio, where the KGB threw his instruments out the window. And the story of it's a whole other story.
Yeah.
The story of Theremin, it's a fascinating story. But if you're interested in it, there's a great documentary called Theremin, An Electronic Odyssey by Stephen D. Martin. And it's a wonderful documentary. He actually introduced me, Stephen, to Lydia Kavina.
Right. Another film of yours that I adore. I adore the film. I think it's probably the single best case ever for 3D films, and that's Hugo. And I love the warmth and the pathos in the music, the sense of period, that feeling of a kind of a Django Reinhardt-infused cafe society jazz band. How did your concept for that film evolve? And by the way, if anyone hasn't seen it, see it.
Well, it's a great period that I'm interested in, and we explored it a bit in the film The Aviator, which is another Martin Scorsese film. It's the period between silent films and when sound was first introduced. And it's a very rich period in music, because with silent film, you had maybe 35 years, actually, of films without sound, except they all had almost all had live accompaniment when they were shown. And that classical world was now going into sound, and you had Dracula score using Tchaikovsky's theme for The Dying Swan, which was actually part of Ed Wood.
Interesting.
I used that theme for when Bella,
Yes, I remember.
Dies.
I remember. Yes, absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
Because that's the theme of Todd Browning's 1939 or 31, I think, Dracula. Anyways, Hugo, was a labor of love. It's a film about filmmaking. And I'm making the film with Martin Scorsese, one of the greatest living film directors. And so it's...
But also one of the greatest living film lovers and cineasts.
Yes, and we're making a film about cinema. What a wonderful thing. And so I had, again, the London Philharmonic, mostly recorded at Abbey Road. you know, the score was just a labor of love. And I love French chanson, and Marty loves Django Reinhardt, and all those things all factored into it. And remembering that, you know, cinema began in France. And so it was really a heartfelt love note to France, to the music of France, cafe orchestras. You know, it was all part of that. What I did was I wrote for a small cafe orchestra group and then surrounded that with the London Phil.
Right. And it is beautiful. And again, one of those scores that plays beautifully as concert music, just as standalone music. It's gorgeous. I'm going to take my life in my hands with you for a moment and touch on what I think might be a bit of a sensitive issue, but let me try it. It seems to me that there are, in a sense, two kinds of composers for film. And I'd compare them to the classic Hollywood star type of actor who were always recognizable. You know, Humphrey Bogart, Katharine Hepburn, Marilyn Monroe, you know, no matter what role they played, they would always be immediately recognizable as themselves. And then later on with Brando and later generations, there were the method actors who would go so deep into the heart of a role that they would transform themselves and become unrecognizable. And for my ears in film music, there are what I call the instantly recognizable composers, the ones like Korngold, Max Steiner, Bernard Herrmann, Nino Rota, Ennio Morricone, maybe Maurice Jarre. And it seems that we've evolved into a phase that is much more comparable to the method actor approach, where the composers really immerse themselves in an idiom that is particular to the film and its themes, and in a sense, a much more diverse film language has evolved. Would it upset you to be thought of as being one of those method actor schools of composers, even though it means that the instantly recognizable signature may not always be there?
I think you could say that, and that I am in that school, because I devote myself to trying to make the best film and the best period musically for that particular environment, you know, whether it's, you know, Middle Earth or William Burroughs' Naked Lunch with Ornette Coleman. So each project is really specifically designed to create the world of the film. In its harmonic structure, its counterpoint, its orchestration, its use of soloists. I'm very much in the method actor world. But I think over the years, or at least I'm told, that there's some element of my own choices or whatever they are that make things sound a little more distinctively like my own.
I think that's true.
People can recognize your work and say, oh, that sounds like a Shore progression or a Shore harmonic shift or a Shore tempo, or, you know. So I think there's approaches that I take that I do probably do on all the work that I do.
Right.
You know, that are internal choices about how to use music in the film. Essentially, you know, point of view. So what is your point of view for using music in that scene? So that's more a Shore technique. And then the method part is just losing yourself into the world of the story.
Right. And I would say, rather than putting it in technical terms, for me, things like a Shore sense of wistfulness, a Shore sense of nostalgia, regret, you know, certain mood elements that I think are evoked sometimes in very, very different language, but still I feel it from an affect point of view.
Yeah. I think you bring your own world to it. Like on the score to A Song of Names, It was so, that was so exact. I don't know if you know that film.
I do. Francois Girard is a good friend and, of course, yeah, the director of 32 short films about Glenn Gould. So
exactly, yeah. But that that was a wonderful collaboration with Francois. And the period of the film was my exact period when I was discovering that music and hearing it for the first time in the early 50s. So it was very internal, the score.
And a very powerful score, yeah, which is very violin-centric, but also vocally-centered.
Ray Chen, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about Lord of the Rings, because, of course, it's such a massive piece, actually two pieces, but six films in your work. And some would regard it as the project of a lifetime because it's a legend and generations literally grew up having their lives and their inner lives shaped by these literary works. How did the project come to you? Did you know Peter Jackson beforehand?
No, I just, the phone rang and he was there one day and he told me about what he was doing. I had no awareness the film was being made. I read the book in the 60s when I was with Lighthouse on the bus touring around like a lot of students at that time and young people were doing. And so I knew the story, but didn't know about the film. And he told me about what he was doing. He invited me to come to New Zealand and I did.
Did he start by saying, how would you like to give me 4 or 5 years of your life?
No, you didn't really know what you were really getting yourself into. And I think maybe it was better not to know every detail.
Right.
But I took one step at a time and I went to New Zealand and the filmmaking was extraordinary. You know, I mean, the beauty of Alan Lee and John Howe, they were the two Tolkien illustrators and artists, when you saw their work and what they were going to create, and you met Fran Walsh and Philippa Boyens, the two screenwriters. So it looked like it was going to be a great collaboration. The work was extraordinary. You didn't want to say no and get back on the plane and go back to America. So, you know, you signed on to this fantastic journey.
I mean, obviously a monumental project for everyone involved.
Yeah, it took me almost 4 years to write.
And many hours of music. It was clearly going to be an immense undertaking. But also, I think, as you've alluded, you had read the books and you knew how much they meant to so many readers. Did that give you a certain added sense of responsibility in being part of bringing this project to life?
Absolutely. I carried around, as many people did, the Tolkien book. The Tolkien book was on my desk for all the years I was writing it. It was so important for us to be true to what he wrote. So we always were going back and referencing his work. Again, it was a labor of love. I mean, it was something that you were just kind of, it was the right place for you to be at that time. You were at the right age. You had the right experience. You had the right energy to be able to do that. So all the elements kind of came together in a positive way.
You know, one of the things that I love that and that is very striking is the extensive use of choirs and vocal music, and in many cases, singing text directly from the songs and poems in Tolkien's books in Elvish and Dwarvish and Black speech. It's a brilliant idea, and one that is, in a sense, not necessarily going to jump out and be obvious to every viewer, but right. I think it's part of the commitment and integrity. How hard was it to execute that?
It was such a simple idea. And I remember it came on one of my trips to New Zealand. I thought, there's all these poems and song lyrics in the book. How do we put this in the film? We can't stop the film and sing a song or read a poem. That became the idea of putting it into the score in a way through the choirs. It was, we always use a 60 voice mixed choir and a 50 voice boys choir and many soloists. We probably had about 12 different instrumental and vocal soloists. So it was a way to put those Tolkien poems and song lyrics back into it. And even though it was used, and the fact that it was used all through the film, I think broadened the text of the story, because you were putting this information into it. Even if you weren't completely aware of it, you were hearing Dwarvish sung correctly. You were hearing Sindarin and Quenya sung correctly. We were checked and checked by David Sallow, who did the translations, and Roisin Carty was an Irish linguist who did all the international phonetics, so everybody sang everything correctly.
Wow.
Which we learned in studying Tolkien was very important to him. The sound of his creations was of utmost importance, so we tried to honor that as much as we could.
Because he was part academically of that world that understood the bardic traditions that combined storytelling and song and verse.
Right.
You often have spoken about the importance of silence in film, but for scoring Lord of the Rings, there's a lot less silence. It's a very through-composed set of films. Was there a reason for that? Was it something that Peter Jackson wanted? Did he want a kind of a continuous presence of the musical element to underscore, reveal elements of the text, of the drama? Or was that something that you arrived at mutually?
I think we arrived at it mutually. It was a technique, I think, to keep the audience in the world of Middle Earth. And I think Peter, maybe more than I did, felt that the use of the music was good for pacing. It was good for storytelling, but it was also particularly because we used over 100 motifs and thematic ideas, it was a way for clarity of storytelling, which is what he was really interested in. I remember with Cronenberg, we weren't interested so much in clarity of storytelling to the audience. You could decide yourself how you felt about these images in this story.
Right. And ambiguity is a much greater part of his work than
it's kind of fun in a way, because you can make up your own mind about these scenes and about the story and about, instead of us telling you everything. Where with Tolkien and clarity, you kind of needed it, because not everybody had read this huge novel and understood the worlds of the elves, the difference between Rivendell and Lothlorien. They needed different thematic ideas for clarity, or the worlds of Rohan and Gondor of men. So the music and the motifs and the themes were used for clarity. It was a way to help people to understand where the sword came from.
Right.
And who Aragorn was and his lineage and things like that.
Exactly. And of course, I can't help but notice a certain Wagnerian technical approach. Obviously, the use of leitmotifs and their evolution and transformation throughout, even though Tolkien himself always said that Wagner's Ring and his Ring were completely separate and had nothing whatsoever to do with each other. But was Wagner kind of a hidden presence in your mind in the evolution of this kind of vast musical tapestry?
Well, I worked on the piece so long that my interest in the beginning was more in Italian opera. I like Verdi and Puccini, and I think you hear more of that in Fellowship of the Ring and maybe Two Towers. And then maybe about halfway through Two Towers, I started transitioning into Wagner and Bruckner. And you hear more of that influence, I think, in Return of the King.
Right.
And then at the end of the trilogy, I wrote a piece that was kind of a tip of the hat to Wagner.
The musical influences seem also to relate to the different worlds in Middle-earth, the different cultures. So, for example, for the Shire, which is very rustic and idyllic, there's a slightly Celtic flavor to my ears. For Rohan, it has a kind of a Scandinavian, almost Norse quality, especially your use of the Hardanger fiddle. Were you intentionally trying to evoke existing subconscious associations that we would have with cultures that would be familiar, so we'd have a kind of a touchstone or a point of reference to hang on to?
Well, yes, in the sense that I had this vast story to tell. And Tolkien points the compass in four directions.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could just follow the pointing of the compass. So I had instruments from north, south, east, west. West, I had the Celtic instruments. North, the Hardanger. South, I had the African instruments, and east, I had Chinese and Japanese gongs and cymbals. And
right.
I also used Indian flutes and Indian bowed lutes for Lothlorien. So I was using instruments, you know, from the four points of the compass, really.
We're coming close to the end of our time, but before I leave Middle Earth, one of the qualities that I think for me makes Lord of the Rings a great work of literature, a great world work of literature, not just a popular fantasy work, is, and I think it's very deeply realized and reflected in your score, aside from the fact that, you know, it's heroic and there are these great exciting battles, is this kind of continuously mounting sense of gloom and despair that accompanies Frodo's journey. It's kind of the contrast between the green and good rustic life in the Shire that he's left to that industrial hellscape that Saruman has made of Isengard and the kind of scorched earth in Mordor. And I know that that sense of grief was very real to Tolkien because he lived through the trenches of World War I and experienced that kind of industrialized butchery and also saw the green and pleasant land that he grew up in and being supplanted more and more by industrial development. There's a sense of the passing of an era when Frodo goes to the Grey Havens. And again, there's this, I would say, underlying feeling of nostalgia and regret and grief that is much deeper than just the triumphalism of the ending. Now, like Tolkien, you live in a very rustic setting. You've mentioned that you live in a forest. Could you relate to those emotional currents on a very personal level?
I related to Tolkien through nature.
Yeah.
His love of nature. Lord of the Rings is essentially a war movie, a battle for everything green and good, to preserve the world, the good world. And I could relate to that. And I live with nature every day. And I think that was my connection. I live in an oak wood, an oak forest, and I watch it season by season change. And with my wife, Elizabeth, we live in a kind of 19th century, 1910 house that we restored and restored the gardens. And as the restoration, this is going back to 1990, over 30 years ago, but as the house was restored and the gardens restored, I noticed that my music improved. It kept growing. And so by the time I got to Lord of the Rings, I was well into the restoration, and I was again ready for this grand adventure. But that was always the connection, was always through nature.
with Lord of the Rings, the era of not having enough budget was probably like a long forgotten thing of the past, because I have to imagine that every resource imaginable was at your disposal.
I had an orchestra of 230 musicians, 96-piece symphony orchestra, 60-voice choir, 40-50 boys choir, and about 12 soloists. And right. I could choose soloists from different worlds. Like I had Renee Fleming and James Galway and Enya and
right.
Fellowship of the Ring. So,
and Annie Lennox.
Annie Lennox, of course, yeah. The resources were vast, and it was just the clock, really.
Right.
You were just facing the clock. But as long as you stayed focused, you could keep up with the work, and I managed to do it. A good illustrator told me, John Howe told me, he says, just keep the pencil moving. And I like that idea,
yes,
compositionally, that you're not actually writing music unless you actually are writing music.
Did you ever have the temptation on the podium to say, okay, gang, and when we're done with this, we're just going to lay down the Mahler Symphony of 1,000? Just for fun.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, I can't leave without talking a little bit, just in conclusion, about your life as a composer of concert music. You've written an opera based on The Fly, which is a great work, very different in an almost completely original new work compared to the film score. You've written a piano concerto for long, chamber music. You wrote, was it a fanfare for the largest musical instrument in the world, the Wanamaker organ, which must have been a trip and a half.
It was a thrill.
28,000 pipes. I made a record with the Wanamaker organ. It was a nightmare. Is this going forward going to be an increasing part of your life? Do you have the freedom now to do more purely discretionary projects, just the music you want to write for yourself?
Well, again, the interest in music. So I follow the opportunities, you know, what orchestra I can work with, who the piece is written for, the time frame. The soloist is very important. The soloists I worked with were fantastic, you know, with long. Sophie Chow did the cello concerto, and the guitar concerto was written for Milos. So that those relationships with the soloists, extremely important. If they come along and the commissions are there, I'm very happy to do it. There's always secret projects I'm working on all the time. There's pages going on that develop into pure pieces, counterpoint or harmonic ideas I'm interested in. I'm essentially writing every morning in the studio, whether it's a film or a concert piece.
Well, that brings us to my second last question, which is there an unrealized dream project that you still want to do, that you absolutely, this is the thing more than anything else that will make me feel whole if I get to do this thing?
No, I don't think so. I don't have that. You know, I've really been able to accomplish a lot of the things I was interested in. You know, I think I'll continue composing and keep writing. And I like working with orchestras, but I'm also becoming more interested in electronic music.
Interesting.
Crimes of the Future is mostly an electronic score, you know, that's created specifically for the film. And then I did some recording with the Penderecki String Quartet in Waterloo, Ontario, and they added some humanity to the electronics. But I've been very fortunate, I'm, you know, in realizing a lot of my musical ideas and my dreams, and I'll just continue following the pencil.
Well, I have to say that your musical work brings dreams to life, because in many ways, the dreams that lie underneath the text and the images come through your scores. And I did want to leave with one last thing, which is that we were very grateful that you were a juror for the Glenn Gould Prize. And of course, you grew up in the Toronto that was inhabited by Glenn Gould. This year is his 90th anniversary year. He would have turned 90 this September 25th. And I'm just wondering if you have any reflections on what influence as an artist he had, not necessarily on you, but, you know, the kind of legacy that he has left in the musical world.
When I was in Lighthouse, there was a violist that played in Lighthouse called Don DeNovo, who was a good friend of Gould's. And I was on tour with Don for years. And in the morning, he would be very tired and hardly able to, you know, wake up. And I'd say, Don, what's going on with you? You know, why are you so tired all the time? He said, oh, I'm on the phone with my friend Glenn. And he'd be on the phone with Glenn like in all hours of the night, 2-3 in the morning. So that was really my first kind of introduction to him. And then on A Dangerous Method, I wanted to do a version of the Siegfried Idyll for Long Long. And of course, I listened to Gould, and that was influential. I thought it would take me a weekend. It took 4 months.
Oh, wow. No small feat. Well, Howard, thank you. And thank you for the gift of the music that you have given us. When I dream of scenes from films, your music is part of those dreams. When I think about moments dramatically that have really resonated with me, your melodies and harmonies are often part of it. And I can't wait to see Crimes of the Future and hear what you've come up with for that.
Great. I think you'll enjoy it.
Well, I know I'll be disturbed by it.
Well, that's what I meant. You'll enjoy it in the disturbing nature.
Right. Thank you so much, Howard.
You're welcome. Good talking to you.
All right. Take care.
And thanks for all your work you're doing on the foundation and with the Gould Foundation. Yeah, it's fantastic, Brian. Thank you.
And weary head, night is falling. You've come to Jenny's end. Sleep now, dream of the ones who came before. They are calling from across the distant shore. Why do you weep? What are these tears upon your face? Soon you will see all of your fears will pass away. Safe my
Well, friends, that was our conversation with film composer and composer overall, par excellence, Howard Shore. We're so grateful to Howard for taking the time to share his insights and his experience with us. And I'd love it if you would reflect on and let us know your favorite Howard Shore film music or concert music. I have my own favorites, but I'd love to hear from you, gentle listeners, what musical and film moments have really resonated most deeply with you. And Rudrapriya, I really found it fascinating to hear that Howard manages to combine the world of high technology with the old-fashioned approach of composing with a pencil and piece of music score.
Me too, Brian. I love the way he talks about, you know, his writing process as just keeping the pencil moving. That's so relevant and so inspiring for so many different artists.
Absolutely. And now I suspect that you have some invaluable information, Rudrapriya, that you would like to share with our friends.
I do. The Glenn Gould Foundation is a registered Canadian charity, and we really rely on the support of arts lovers like you to continue bringing inspiring stories to life. Please consider giving by visiting our website, glenngould.ca. And if you're interested in keeping up with the Gold Standard podcast and more work from the foundation, be sure to follow us across social media on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at the Glenn Gould Foundation.
So it is written, so shall it be done. Thank you so much, friends, for joining us again. And please be with us for the next episode of the Gould Standard. We have many surprises in store.